time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we're going to be answering the question, why did I wake up feeling rested? Our guest is Dr. Ashtad Dalal. Welcome, Dr. Dalal. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks. So you are a doctor of sleep medicine, correct?
Correct. The actual term, although it's not really used at all, somnologist, but you don't really hear people say that. Usually it's sleep doctor, sleep medicine doctor. But yeah, somnologist is
the fancy term, I suppose.
Okay. And I would assume the reason people don't use that is it's harder to pronounce than sleep doctor.
Probably.
All right. Well, so from a somnologist point of view, we get this question all the time. I go to bed, I wake up, but I don't feel rested. My bed partner maybe says something to me like, wow, you snore really loudly, or, you know, you were gasping throughout the night. So what is going on with these situations?
So I think, first of all, there's a myriad of reasons, right, why one might not wake up feeling rested in the morning. If there's complaints of snoring or the person's waking up gasping, kind of under the assumption common things are common, you think about snoring and sleep apnea, namely sleep apnea, as a cause. But the truth is, you know, in the absence of those symptoms, a number of things can impact one's sleep, right? And that's always important to take into account. And my general approach is always looking kind of at the whole person. What is background, age, demographics, what do they do for work? What's the routine schedule? What medications are they taking? What medical problems? Just kind of like a full intake that's like a psychosocial intake as well as a medical intake, just to get an idea of the whole picture. Because really the truth is everything can impact one's sleep. And by the same token, one's sleep can have an impact on all these different matters, and of course, daytime functioning. But yeah, to your point, exactly, if we're talking about loud snoring that's disruptive and the patient is waking up, gasping, feeling like they can't get good breath in, the concern is that of really obstructive sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the interesting thing here is that we talk about someone, you know, being told maybe that they have been gasping for air or snoring loudly, but they're asleep. They don't know that this is happening in most cases, right?
This is one of the trickiest parts, and it's a topic and a phrase that I use several times per day with patients. Well, I think I sleep just fine. I don't know what the issue is, you know. I wake up, I feel fine is another thing, but the incredible part is, right, the body is able to compensate, and changes might take place, you know, with one's physiology very gradually, so that any kind of changes would really be imperceptible to the individual, or at least can be.
Uh-huh.
And on top of that, the other symptoms that might be audible, like snoring, et cetera, they might not be aware of it at all. Or even the episodes of choking or gasping or of apnea itself. And I feel like it's probably a good time to mention, right, what apnea. Apnea really just means not breathing. So is all that it means.
Uh-huh.
So an individual might not have any recollection of any of this. If there's a bed partner present to observe this, then that might tip them off. You know, and now with everyone having phones in their pockets and recording devices, oftentimes I'll have spouses or partners come in with the patient and play me recordings of the person sleeping. And that then might not even be the impetus for them to come in to see me, because otherwise they're not necessarily in denial, but just disbelief that that is actually what is happening.
Right.
Another part is if the person's living alone, but they have some sort of other medical condition that can be made more difficult to manage or may develop as a result of undiagnosed, untreated obstructive sleep apnea, that is often the impetus also to have patients come in for evaluation of obstructive sleep apnea.
So, you know, you answered a question that I have here, but I have a little bit more follow-up from that, which is this. So, you know, we're talking about someone with a bed partner who recognizes that they're snoring loudly or maybe gasping for air. So that's let's call that an easy case because you got someone there who's saying, this is what I hear. So you got people who sleep alone. And so if they don't have a bed partner to tell them, they may never know this is happening. And my question to you is, so if they don't know what's happening and it's not bothering anybody, what do they need to be concerned about? Anything?
So a good question. If a tree falls in the forest, right, does anyone hear it?
Right.
It's tricky. And so, like I said, one main reason I end up seeing patients coming in for evaluation who don't have a bed partner is some other concurrent medical condition that another physician or healthcare provider may be tipped off to, saying, well, do you think you snore? And if the answer is, I'm unsure of that, even still, it might be worthwhile to have the evaluation because of the tight correlation with untreated obstructive sleep apnea. What are some examples of these medical conditions? The first one that comes to mind is any kind of arrhythmia, which is to say any kind of irregular heart rhythm, heartbeat, with which there is a tight correlation with untreated obstructive sleep apnea, elevated blood pressure that's difficult to control and manage. The patient may end up being on multiple antihypertensive medications, multiple blood pressure medications in an effort to try and manage their blood pressure, but still is proving difficult. That should also trigger the thought of, is there a potential of undiagnosed, untreated obstructive sleep apnea that may be contributing to that. Other kind of symptoms that, you know, individuals can be aware of that don't necessitate, you know, somebody observing them. Actually, the most common associated symptom is morning headaches. So waking up with a headache that's kind of generalized, but maybe more frontal, temporal, along the front and sides of the head, that is generally kind of described as a dull overall kind of heaviness or fog. And then throughout the morning, it kind of dissipates as the person is waking up and going about their day. Other things that can be associated, dry mouth, waking up with a dry mouth in the morning, waking up with a sore throat, swollen uvula. These are all kind of associated symptoms with untreated obstructive sleep apnea that aren't just snoring.
Uh-huh.
And then also to your point about what if there isn't anyone there to observe what's going on when the person's sleeping. Of course, there's an app for it, right? So there's multiple apps for the phone that will kind of record decibel levels throughout the night and record snoring. And then it'll actually even chart it for individuals to see, okay, where was it loudest, you know, beginning, middle, or end of the night, and then can kind of correlate it, or you might often find people correlating it with other kind of wearables. So, you know, like Fitbits, Apple Watches, et cetera. So there are ways to go about kind of checking and kind of self-evaluating too.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's one of the interesting things going on in the sleep field today, as you state, is all of these different wearables and different type of apps and ways for people to be aware of their sleep. And, you know, we'll do a different episode about some potential issues those may cause on the negative side. But for purposes of today's discussion, you know, so I guess the first step is a person, especially if they don't have any particular issue that their doctor is telling them about, or they don't have a bed partner, they've got to be aware that this is something that could be an issue for them, because if they don't treat it, it could be dangerous and cause other medical conditions and other mental health conditions. So are there any pointers or things that you would say that if someone is listening to this show, is there something they can look at about themselves that may say to them, you might be at a higher risk of having sleep apnea than someone else?
Sure. Answer that question, but two things going back to the previous question to be aware of. One is how we started this whole conversation, which is waking up in the morning and not feeling well rested. That should also be a trigger. But like I said, that can often be difficult to tease out as an individual, because that change might happen so gradually. And like I was saying, the physiology kind of compensating might be tougher to detect. And by the same token, you know, what they classify as excessive daytime sleepiness, where the person just is feeling sleepy, exhausted throughout the day, kind of slogging and dragging through the day. And some people are able to self-evaluate and say, well, I didn't used to feel like this. So, you know, it seems like something has changed. I can't necessarily attribute it to any one thing. So then that should also maybe trigger the thought in one's mind.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of kind of self-evaluating for risk factors, obesity, of course, is potentially the biggest of these in terms of correlation with obstructive sleep apnea. But even more so than that, and this is true for just about everybody, is the really the anatomy of the back of the throat, which is really for everyone where the cause of snoring and obstructive sleep apnea lies. And within that, it's actually the tongue that's the main culprit in this story. The tongue, the tonsils, the uvula, the tissue above the uvula, these structures will collapse to the back of the throat. And it'll either partially cover up the airway and it'll rattle and the person snores, or it'll completely cover up the airway and the person stops breathing. And again, that's what they call apnea.
Uh-huh.
And again, person may be totally unaware of any of this happening because they are sleeping.
Right.
So those are kind of two of the main things to look out for. And to that point, you know, I'll often hear, you know, my partner will say, oh, you know, I really only snore if I've had a few beers or a few glasses of wine that night. And that's, you know, of note and a good detail to share, because really what alcohol is doing, right, it relaxes, is going to relax all the muscles, is going to include those muscles in the back of the throat, making one more prone for this potential collapse in the back of the throat of these structures, increasing the potential for snoring and apnea as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hear, and I think a lot of us hear often about someone with obesity, maybe someone who is may have apnea. And so, okay, we accept that. What about someone like, for example, I was speaking with a lady just the other day, not obese at all, you know, within her appropriate body mass, probably in her mid-40s. But says she thinks she may have sleep apnea just because her bed partner mentions about snoring and things. Is she potentially a candidate for actually having obstructive apnea?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the way I usually describe it is that it's due to these two factors, weight and the anatomy in the back of the throat. But the bigger of the two is categorically that of the anatomy. So one does not necessarily have to be obese or overweight at all to have obstructive sleep apnea. It really strictly more so has to do with how open the airway is and how much really space the tongue has to sit inside of the mouth. And you brought up another interesting point about, you know, women in general, females in general, predilection favors male to female when it comes to obstructive sleep apnea.
Right.
The qualifier there is premenopausal females.
Okay.
Postmenopausal females, the predilection evens out male to female. And the science behind that is really the two main hormones that are lost during menopause are estrogen and progesterone. One of the roles that progesterone plays in general is keeping muscle tone. And now with menopause, the progesterone begins to be depleted. That's then going to reduce overall muscle tone. And again, correlates back to the muscles in the back of the throat. So now all of a sudden, again, increased potential for collapse and therefore snoring and apnea as a result of that.
Wow, that's very interesting. So I had not heard that before, and I'm glad that we're talking about it because that is an important thing for people to know. But I got to stop right now to take a commercial break, so give us a second. We'll come back and we'll continue our discussion about sleep apnea and other sleep issues.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back to Sleep Science Today with our guest, Dr. Dalal. He's talking to us about sleep apnea and obstructive sleep apnea. Where we left off gave me another question that I really wanted to follow up with here, which is, okay, so we've got someone who believes they may have sleep apnea. They have a lot of the common signs. They sort of fit the profile. What do we do about it today in terms of testing? And maybe if you could kind of take us through sort of the evolution of testing. Can you test for sleep apnea? How do you test for sleep apnea? Give us the playing field there.
Sure. So initially, the only sleep study that would happen would be happening in a controlled environment in a sleep lab or sleep laboratory. Initially, would only be found in hospitals and hospital centers. Now there are kind of outpatient sleep labs that exist where patients can go in and have their sleep study done at those facilities. And then more recently, and with a lot more uptake, there are home sleep apnea tests or home sleep studies that have really come into favor, namely with the insurance company as a result of cost.
Mm-hmm.
The general description I give of the two studies when discussing these two main options for diagnosing obstructive sleep apnea, and to be clear, those are currently the only two ways to diagnose obstructive sleep apnea, is to perform a sleep study, whether it is in a sleep lab or at home. The one in a sleep lab, no doubt, is going to be the more accurate of the two. And to be clear also, both, whether it's done in the sleep lab or at home, in my opinion, pros and cons to both, you know. And so that's another reason I think kind of evaluation with individual patients and consultation prior to is so important, to kind of tailor what's going to be best for that given individual.
Uh-huh.
So the one in the sleep lab, no doubt, the more accurate of the two. The home sleep studies, in general, if they return with results that demonstrate obstructive sleep apnea, there's almost certainly obstructive sleep apnea present. If anything, actually, it's an underestimation of the severity of obstructive sleep apnea. However, if it returns and doesn't show obstructive sleep apnea and one strongly suspects it in a given individual, then you really want to verify the results of that study by usually performing an in-lab sleep study. All of this is to say that there is a potential of a false negative rate associated with home sleep studies versus in-lab sleep studies, which continue to kind of be the gold standard in terms of diagnosing obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay.
In terms of kind of logistics and pros and cons that I was referring to, so with the in-lab sleep study, we're in a strange place, strange bed. They are generally performed with using EEG leads on the head to monitor brain waves to track when the person's asleep, and if so, what stage of sleep they're in versus when they're awake. There is a couple of leads on the chest to monitor heart rate and rhythm. There are also muscle kind of EMG leads that track muscle and muscle tone. And then two belts that are worn, one across the chest and abdomen, to measure respiratory effort, how much effort the person's putting into actually breathing, as well as a little nasal cannula in the nostrils that helps measure air flow.
Huh.
So that's the in-lab sleep study versus the home sleep study. There are a number of different devices.
Well, let me stop you there for a second, because I want to ask one question about the sleep lab before we start talking about the home study. Sure. So, you know, you described sounded like a lot of wires in our head, things around our chest, lots of wires and things is what I'm imagining as you're talking about this. But I bet some listeners are having the question, okay, this is a doctor and they're talking about a medical test and they're talking about all these different machines and you know, letters that I don't understand as a patient. Are there any needles?
There are no needles. There's nothing invasive about it whatsoever.
That's the biggest plus, I think.
It is categorized as an outpatient procedure that, you know, the person comes in and they go home, you know, within the same day, you know. So it should, in that regard, is not invasive in the slightest.
Wow. Okay. So that I think is more reassuring for a lot of people. But we're still talking about, you know, I'm envisioning all these wires and leads and all these things coming out of the body. And then you were about to tell us about the home sleep test. Is that the same? Is there a whole bunch of wires and things that people have to set up for themselves, or how do they do it?
Just to be clear, huh? With the in-lab sleep study, all of those different suppliers are really monitoring different variables to give the most complete and accurate data. Right? If there was an easier way to get that quality of data without doing it, we would be doing it now. It's just currently this is the best that is available. And so, like I said, it remains to be the gold standard in terms of diagnosing obstructive sleep apnea.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, you know, to give respect to all the sleep technicians, they are very good generally at what they do and have extensive experience in terms of trying to make individuals feel as comfortable as possible during all of this. So that is important to bear in mind as well.
Right.
With the home sleep studies, I was saying there are multiple different devices that are currently on the market that are approved for diagnosing sleep apnea. Different offices, different providers, physicians might utilize different ones. They are all essentially regulated and kind of certified to be able to diagnose obstructive or sleep apnea in general. There comes a question of whether it can discern obstructive sleep apnea versus central sleep apnea. And we could talk about what the difference between those two things are briefly here, maybe. So obstructive sleep apnea is what we've been talking about thus far, you know, related to weight, but then primarily the anatomy of the back of the throat and the tongue collapsing to the back of the throat.
So an obstruction.
The obstruction, yeah, where the obstruction's taken place, exactly.
Got it.
Whereas central sleep apnea is related really to the brain, central nervous system, and essentially the brain not sending the message to the body to take a breath, to initiate a breath. And so much less common than obstructive sleep apnea, but the question of whether home sleep studies are good enough to diagnose that. Some home sleep study devices purport that, yes, they are. Others do not even take it into consideration. But if there is a concern for central sleep apnea, and I'll name some kind of common potential risk factors for central sleep apnea, then one really should be having the sleep study performed in a sleep lab. So kind of some common causes risk factors for central sleep apnea. Taking any kind of opioid, narcotic, pain medication generally increases the potential for central sleep apnea. So when you hear people say that this medication can lower the respiratory drive, that is essentially what they're saying, what they're getting at. Congestive heart failure is another kind of common cause for central sleep apnea, so it's important to keep on the radar. In terms of when it's appropriate to do which one, a home sleep study versus an in-lab sleep study, there are categorically certain medical conditions that if a patient has that medical condition, then it really necessitates for the sleep study to be done in the sleep lab. Examples of that might include any kind of primary lung disease, namely COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD emphysema, asthma might even fall into that category as well. Any kind of congestive heart failure, like I was just talking about, would be another reason where it really should be done in the sleep lab. And then any kind of neuromuscular disorder. So, you know, talking about ALS or if there's spastic paraplegia, anything like that, you really want to be doing the sleep study in the sleep lab.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got certain conditions where the sleep lab is clearly going to be the better choice. But then you have people who, I don't have time to get there. I don't have time to schedule it. It's too expensive. I'm scared. It's not my bed. So what does a home sleep study actually entail? What what does it look like? How do they do it?
So again, logistics and workflow vary from office to office, but essentially, in general way, what will happen, usually have a consultation with the doctor or healthcare provider discussing the symptoms. The decision has been made. Okay, let's do a sleep study. Okay, given whatever reasons or strictly patient preference, performing a home sleep study is decided upon. And then at that point, the patient will either be sent a home sleep study device in the mail, can be shipped to them, or they will come in to the office, be shown how to use this device. Devices generally will either be, examples might include kind of like a large watch on the wrist with a probe on the finger, and then maybe one lead that sticks onto the chest. Another example might be like a bit of headgear up here.
Mm-hmm.
Another example might be like a single belt or even two belts around the chest and abdomen with kind of like a little box that sits there, or some of the more widely utilized home sleep study devices. If the person comes into the office, generally they'll be shown how to use it. And then they're instructed, and if they're sent, shipped it, usually there's some sort of instructional video that they're shown on how to properly set it up and utilize it. And then at that point, the instructions are really not to do anything different or special the night of that home sleep study, and to sleep just as they usually would. Turn it off in the morning, return it if they had picked it up the next day. If not, if they were shipped in, it's a disposable device, then the data is automatically relayed to the doctor's office. The data then gets reviewed, analyzed, a report is generated, and then a discussion follows regarding the results of that sleep study.
All right, well, I'm going to stop you there because we got to go to commercial again, but I want to come back and pick up from where we left off. So this is Sleep Science Today. We're going to be right back with Dr. Dalal.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Sleep Science Today. Dr. Dalal is joining us to talk about sleep apnea, and we have been talking about obstructive sleep apnea and how to test for it. We were talking about the home sleep study, and you described basically how it all works. So my question to you to follow up is, Do you find in your practice that the home sleep study is relatively easy for people to be able to follow the instructions and do, or is it complicated to the point that they might need some help?
For the vast majority, it's straightforward enough for them to take it home and effectively and efficiently utilize it. There are, of course, outliers there, and if a person tries to use it and for whatever reason, operator error or just the study itself is technically inadequate, you might try, depending again on patient preference, if they prefer doing it at home, utilizing a different type of home sleep study device that for that given individual might be more intuitive to use versus having them come into the sleep lab where there's kind of more careful monitoring and assurance that the data that needs to be collected is being collected in a way that's accurate and reflects what's actually going on.
I see. Okay, so we've got a pretty good idea now of the fact that there is this thing called obstructive sleep apnea that is caused by an obstruction in the throat, the tongue going back in the throat, basically. There's central sleep apnea, which is more from the brain than an obstruction. Correct. We've talked about testing in a sleep lab versus testing at home. So now we will know whether or not you actually have sleep apnea. So let's move to the next step. Let's assume that the person does have sleep apnea, whether it be obstructive or whether it be central. What do we do about it? How do you treat it?
So again, this kind of depends on the given individual. And so in my mind, right, with medicine in general, it is not one size fits all. So having a conversation about it. If there's central sleep apnea that's diagnosed, then it kind of narrows things down in terms of treatment. Really, the first line therapy for central sleep apnea is still going to be CPAP. So that's continuous positive airway pressure. And that would actually necessitate a second sleep study in the sleep lab, trying out the CPAP and seeing if CPAP alone is able to overcome and treat the person's central sleep apnea. And if not, trying a different type of modality and therapy to treat their central sleep apnea.
Okay.
With obstructive sleep apnea, again, it also depends in terms of treatment and course, patient preference. Wholly my opinion and anecdotal, but I try and focus on what is the patient most likely to utilize in a consistent way that would be then sustainable for them moving forward. And so having a conversation about the different treatment options, of course, in relation to them and their sleep study results. And to that point, really when looking at a sleep study, what they're looking at essentially is the number of times per hour of stopping breathing in this sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And they use this acronym AHI, where the A stands for apnea, which we said just means not breathing. The H stands for hypopnea, which means essentially close to not breathing. And then the I stands for index, because it's the number of times per hour that it's happening. So again, essentially, it's the number of times per hour of stopping breathing in the sleep.
I see.
And they say with an AHI of less than 5, that would be then categorized as potentially the person is snoring, but without clinically significant obstructive sleep apnea. With an AHI of 5 to 15, or put it another way, stopping breathing in the sleep 5 to 15 times per hour, that would be classified as mild obstructive sleep apnea. With an AHI of 15 to 30, that would be classified as moderate obstructive sleep apnea. And then with an EHI greater than 30, it's then classified as severe obstructive sleep apnea.
Huh.
Then tailoring kind of treatment options often depends on the degree severity of the obstructive sleep apnea for a given individual in terms of likelihood of how effectively it might treat their obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay.
So, you know, the way I'll usually preface this conversation with patients is by saying kind of the annoying, unfortunate part when it comes to snoring and obstructive sleep apnea is because it's a structural issue really having to do with one's anatomy, there is no simple, easy treatment option, unfortunately. There's no tablet pill to take yet.
Uh-huh.
Everything is kind of odd and takes getting used to. In general, things that can help, no doubt, you know, if one's overweight or there's obesity, diet, exercise, weight loss, weight management, which, you know, this influx of GLP-1 agonists has kind of ramped that up, and awareness and understanding and, you know, utilization as well. So that certainly can help. In general, avoiding sleeping on the back can help, because if we think of it even just conceptually, if the person is sleeping flat on their back, the tongue is going to be much more likely, just because of gravity really, to collapse straight to the back of the throat and obstruct the airway there. So avoiding sleeping on the back, sleeping on the sides or stomach is preferable in regards to this. To the extent where there are patients where they only have clinically significant obstructive sleep apnea when they are sleeping on their back.
Uh-huh.
So kind of positional therapy on its own could be sufficient for a given individual. And there are a number of different tools and devices specifically designed and made for patients with positional obstructive sleep apnea that will kind of coax them or prevent them and train them to avoid sleeping on the back. Or other devices might be aimed at kind of elevating the head of the bed to try and fight gravity and that collapse in the back of the throat. Example might be like a wedge pillow or adjustable mattress. Those things can also be utilized in terms of treating certain patients' obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay, so there's some good news there, because, you know, we often hear about the CPAP machine, I think is the most common thing we hear about. But it sounds like from what you're saying that depending on the person, they may actually be able to improve or treat their apnea simply by changing their sleep position or something much more inconsequential.
Correct, yeah. That's the way you prefaced it, by saying for certain individuals and dependent on their degree severity of sleep apnea and whether there is a positional component to their obstructive sleep apnea or not, all really should be taken into account.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this, because we've got a little over 2 minutes left and I want to make sure I get some of these main questions in. What about the implants that we hear about, where they can get some sort of a stimulator or something? Tell us about that.
Sure. So going through kind of the other treatment options before getting up to the surgical treatment options, right? Just so that we don't leave it out too much. Generally, for milder sleep apnea, maybe the low end of moderate obstructive sleep apnea, there are oral devices that exist or mandibular advancement devices, mandible meaning jaw, advancement meaning pulling forward device. So kind of fitting top and bottom in one's mouth and putting traction on the bottom jaw to help open up the airway is the intention.
Mm. Okay.
Those are typically fitted by dentists. Don't necessarily know how well they'll work until one has one. And then can reassess with the device in place once it's been adjusted and the patient is tolerating it well, to see how effective it is in terms of treating obstructive sleep apnea. There are some nasal devices that exist that are really better suited for those with milder sleep apnea, sleep with the mouth closed. That kind of creates some back pressure to help open up the airway. The CPAP we touched on. And then comes kind of surgical treatment options for obstructive sleep apnea, which generally in my mind for most kind of is a last resort. All these other treatment options, including others we didn't list perhaps, have been exhausted. And for one reason or another, the person's not able to tolerate it. They had, poor outcome with it, whatever the reason, then surgical treatment options exist. And majority of the time, these evaluations and procedures are performed by ear, nose, throat doctors or ENTs, where they'll kind of evaluate the individual's anatomy, potentially even do a scope to see at what level is this obstruction of the airway taking place, as well as how is the obstruction occurring. And then depending on that, discussing with the individual different surgical treatment options, one of which is this hypoglossal nerve stimulator, the brand name of which current one out on the market is Inspire, which is essentially a pacemaker for the tongue is what it is.
Right.
And it's for people who meet certain criteria, namely moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea, generally a BMI less than 40, having tried and failed or intolerant to CPAP for any reason, and then a certain type of collapse that's occurring of the airway that, again, is evaluated for by the ENT.
Okay, so I've got to stop you there because we're out of time. Let me give you just a chance for last word. If there's anything important you wanted to make sure you said, we've got about 10 seconds.
All right. No, I would say just being mindful about the kind of general symptoms, self-awareness, and self-assessing in terms of if I'm waking up feeling sleepy, tired, and there is no other kind of discernible cause, should I be thinking about obstructive sleep apnea in general?
Great, great. Well, Dr. Dalla, I want to really thank you for taking your time out of your busy schedule to join us and explain all these things to us today. I think we learned a lot. So for those of you listening, this is what Sleep Science Today is all about. We talk about the important sleep-related issues out there. We try to educate you about evidence-based situations and bring you quality guests like Dr. Dalal here. I encourage you to go to our website, www.sleepsciencetoday.com, and sign up to claim your free ebook and register for other special offers and promotions. We'll make you aware of things that the general public will not be made aware of. So thank you all for joining us. We look forward to seeing you on our next episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, Sleep Science Today and sleep better tonight.